From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I am a mother.
I am a wife.
Soy tu hermana.
I am a senior citizen.
I am
about to be married.
I am hurt.
I'm happy to be alive.
My world changed the day I was raped.
I was really afraid to speak up about this.
It's been so important that I talk about it.
You cannot recover from rape in isolation.
You are not alone.
You are not alone. Rape survivors talk about rebuilding their lives. The FARC admits killing three North Americans in Colombia, and President Clinton apologizes for U.S. support of the Guatemalan military over the last 40 years. We'll speak with a Guatemalan survivor whose family was disappeared by a military officer trained at the School of the Americas. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President Clinton wraps up his Central American visit today at a summit with the region's leaders. Trade and immigration top the agenda. Participants will discuss the president's proposal to grant the region new trade preferences. They'll also discuss new U.S. plans to deport illegal immigrants. President Clinton also apologized for U.S. support and training of the Guatemalan military during that country's military and paramilitary 36-year reign of terror. We'll talk more about that in a few minutes. East Timor guerrilla leader Xanana Gusmao still held under house arrest in Jakarta, and the leader of the pro-Indonesian Timorese militias, armed by the Indonesian military, say they have agreed to peaceful discussion of the future. Gusmao said at a joint news conference with João da Silva Tavares, "This is the first meeting, and we have committed to peace." In San Francisco, activists angered by the foreign business dealings of Chevron Corporation pelted the oil company's chief executive with pies. Kenneth Durr was hit yesterday as he arrived for a high school speech on technology. In a parody of Chevron's television advertisements, the activists yelled, "Do people really kill Nigerians for oil? People do."
This is Agent Apple of the Biotic Baking Brigade calling to say that we pied the CEO of Chevron, Kenneth Durr, today. Because we believe in thinking globally but acting locally. Abroad, Chevron has created an enormous amount of environmental destruction and is responsible for murdering nonviolent activists in Nigeria. Here at home, in California's Bay Area, their Richmond refinery has topped the list of the nation's largest toxic waste emitters. So, this is Agent Apple saying, when it comes to defending the earth from corporate crime, the pie's the limit.
Chevron spokesperson Mike Libby said a couple of environmental groups have claimed we're complicit in several deaths in Nigeria, which involved the military police, and the fact is we have no involvement whatsoever. Chevron spokespeople have admitted otherwise to Democracy Now! And to Ohio Congressmember Dennis Kucinich, who is calling for a congressional investigation into the killings in Nigeria. The Ecuadorian president, working with economic advisors on a potentially drastic new economic program, kept troops on the streets for a second straight day today during a general strike. Facing the small Andean nation's worst financial crisis in decades after the local currency plunged in value last week, the president has declared a national state of emergency and deployed thousands of troops to control protesters. Palestinian policemen clash with protesters in the Gaza Strip in a fresh wave of riots sparked by a court-imposed death sentence against a former activist of the Muslim militant Hamas group. Police detained six journalists and confiscated their film when they tried to cover the protests. Two Palestinians were killed in similar clashes yesterday. The U.S. military insists the anthrax vaccine is safe, but dozens of servicemen and women have serious doubts, so much so they're willing to disobey orders rather than roll up their sleeves. The Navy says 23 sailors on one of its aircraft carriers have been fined, demoted, and given extra duty for refusing the vaccinations. The Pentagon wants to inoculate more than 2 million active duty and reserve military members by the year 2005. There are fears that the vaccine is untested and unreliable. Just last month, 11 pilots in California's Air Force Reserve quit rather than take the shots. The Girl Scouts are being sued for denying membership to an 8-year-old who is HIV positive. The suit was filed yesterday in New York City by the Legal Action Center on behalf of Quashan Donovan. The child's mother says her daughter was rejected from 11 Girl Scout troops last year. The suit charges the local scout troops with discrimination and the national organization with aiding and abetting that discrimination. Today, the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Panama enters a final stage as the symbolic handover of Rodman Naval Base marks the twilight of a controversial military presence lasting almost a century. Under a 1977 treaty signed by former President Jimmy Carter and the late Panamanian General Omar Torrijos, the United States must pull out all its troops from Panama and hand over the canal and other facilities to the Panamanian government by noon, December 31, 1999. And Ted Kaczynski and Timothy McVeigh could soon have company when they take their exercise. A federal judge says the leader of a gang can take his exercise with the two notorious inmates at the Supermax prison in Florence, Colorado. Luis Felipe is the head of a gang called the Latin Kings. His lawyer asked for the judge's order after Felipe said he was losing his ability to think straight. Felipe is serving a life sentence and has been in solitary confinement for more than 5 years. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Colombia's largest rebel group admitted yesterday that one of its field commanders and three other guerrillas kidnapped and murdered three North Americans, but it defied U.S. calls to surrender them for extradition. The Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, known as the FARC, said it would punish the perpetrators in keeping with its own code of revolutionary justice and that those responsible may face a firing squad. Terence Freitas of Oakland, California, Ingrid Washnuwatok of New York, and Lahe Gay of Hawaii were kidnapped in northeast Arauca province on February 25th. Their bullet-ridden bodies were found bound, blindfolded, and dumped just across the border with Venezuela last Thursday. They had been helping Ua Indians defend their ancestral lands from plans by U.S. multinational Occidental Petroleum to explore for oil. A FARC official identified the field commander accused in the killings only as Commander Hildardo. He said Hildardo had acted without consulting his superiors. Reading from a statement offering apologies to indigenous groups and the international community, Raul Reyes, the FARC leader, said Hildardo had been on a reconnaissance mission with three other guerrillas when they intercepted the North Americans. Earlier this week, the FARC denied responsibility for the murder kidnappings, blaming them on enemies of the country's fledgling peace process, a reference to ultra-right paramilitary gangs or disgruntled sectors of the military. The U.S. State Department issued a condemnation of the FARC after the killings and called for those responsible to be sent for trial in the United States. Germán Briceño is the man who allegedly ordered his men to take the Americans into Venezuela, kill them, and burn their bodies. Briceño is the brother of the FARC's number two commander and top military strategist, Jorge Briceño, alias Mano Jojoy. As head of the FARC's Eastern Bloc Division, Mano Jojoy had ultimate command over the region where the Americans were snatched. Political analysts say the murders could scuttle Colombia's peace process and spark calls for an all-out military offensive against the country's estimated 20,000 rebels who control up to half of Colombian territory. We're joined on the telephone right now by two people. Adam Isaacson is with us. He's an associate at the Demilitarization Program at the Center for International Policy in Washington, D.C. And we're joined by Michael Jimenez, who is a historian who has studied the FARC and Colombian agrarian reform. He teaches at the University of Pittsburgh. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Professor Jimenez, let's begin with you. Your response to the FARC's admission that it was the FARC that killed the three North Americans.
Well, I think that the admission is essentially a way of saying we want to continue the negotiations, that we take responsibility for it, and to some extent it's also an admission that they don't have complete control over all the outlying zones from which where the FARC is operating throughout the country. This is an immense and highly decentralized military operation, I believe.
Can you talk about who the FARC are?
Well, the FARC is lots of different things. It's kind of, if you take a look at it, it's almost like an archaeological dig of Colombian history over the last half century. The fighters who have been out there the longest are groups of people who Some were liberals, others were communists who were involved in the mid-century period known as La Violencia in Colombia, in which some 300,000 Colombians died in what was thought to be just partisan violence, but which many historians now see as an effort by the Colombian elites to push back efforts at reform that had started in the 1930s and 1940s. So you have a group of people who are the oldest generation, and the leader of them, of course, is this man, Manuel Marulanda Vélez, Tiro Fijo, Sure Shot. And they're basically agrarian radicals. What they have always wanted was a plot of land, get the government off my back, government services for smallholders and the like. And many of those people are the original founders, and they attracted a great many people over the years to them. In the 1960s and 70s, with the rise of the pro-national liberation movements, you get increasing groups of people coming from the cities, urban areas, students, professionals, various sorts, workers who join up. Many of them have a much broader vision for transformation of Colombia into a socialist society. And of course, over the decades, there's been the FARC has grown with those folks coming in. But predominantly, its base and most of its support are people in the countryside who have found themselves displaced by growing land concentration, lack of opportunities in rural areas, and in particular, and this is crucial for your viewers, that the FARC is located. Its primary source of support is in the frontiers of the country. When we say that some half to 40% of the national territory is held by the FARC, we're talking, in fact, not about the half or 40% of the country where most of the population lives, but in fact vast areas that are new frontier zones, but very wealthy places. That's to say places where a great deal of money is now being made, whether it's in oil in this particular zone in the Arauca that we've been talking about, or bananas, which is in the border zone with Panama, or cattle areas in the center of the country, in the lowland areas around the rivers. So these are all wealthy zones where we have colonos, or colonizers, many of whom have joined this sort of agrarian communist movement over the years.
You're listening to Professor Michael Jimenez, who is a historian at the University of Pittsburgh, a specialist in Latin American history. Adam Isaacson, you're with the Demilitarization Program at the Center for International Policy in Washington, D.C. What exactly do you think this means right now? And can the head of the FARC get away with saying that this is kind of a renegade, not official murder by the FARC, apologizing and say, let's let the peace process go on?
Well, I think the FARC, now that they've been, first, the admission was a large move for them, the admission that it was the FARC who were involved. But also, maybe a more contrite apology would be is needed to jumpstart the peace process again. Raul Reyes, the FARC spokesman, did say he begged the pardon of his victims and of all indigenous groups in the world, but that may not be enough. The worry, obviously the worry in terms of the implications for Colombia's peace process, which just got started in January, is that this may be the final nail in the coffin. It's already been struggling and stumbling, and really the talks with the FARC froze, were put sort of on hold 2 weeks after they began. There's a worry now that President Pastrana, who ran for president last year on a platform, really the main point being, I will pursue peace talks, may not have enough support within Colombia and outside Colombia, talking about Washington, to keep moving forward with the peace process. President Pastrana, I'm sure, is interested in going forward, but he's going to have to probably convince a lot of skeptics, including Colombia's own business sector, large factions of the military, that it is worth going forward in. Also, one of the main reasons he has gotten as far in the talks as he has with the FARC, actually getting them to sit down for a few meetings, is because he did make some key concessions, not asking for anything in return. The largest one being the demilitarization of five municipalities in southern Colombia. so that the talks could be held there. And these five municipalities are under temporary FARC control until May. Whether future concessions will be as easy to make after this episode is not as clear right now. It would be tragic if the death of these three people will lead to more deaths and the continuation of the war. The other aspect is what's going to happen in Washington. The State Department was quick to point out that it was the FARC. And certainly the State Department has taken some hits from congressional Republicans for being as supportive of President Pastrana and the peace process, including the concessions that Pastrana has so far made to the FARC. This does not put the State Department on stronger ground in its support of Pastrana and the peace process. I think, however, that the official U.S. government line will be to continue following Pastrana's lead if he wants to go forward with the process. However, you're going to find a lot more anonymous quotes from officials in the papers criticizing what's going on, and you're going to read a lot more critiques from congressional Republicans about the future of the peace process and why are we doing this. You're also probably going to see better movement on behalf of increased military and police aid for Colombia.
Something that the three North Americans were very much against, supporting Colombia's military and paramilitary, which although in this case the FARC has claimed credit for these murders, I don't know if we want to put it that way, but taken responsibility for them.
Yeah.
All human rights groups' reports show that the overwhelming violence in Colombia, somewhere more than three-quarters of the violence, is caused by the militaries and paramilitaries. I wanted to go back to Professor Jimenez to ask you about the relationship between the FARC and indigenous peoples, like the UA group of about 4,000 or 5,000 indigenous people in northeastern Colombia. In fact, when these three North Americans were taken from the car by the FARC rebels, they were traveling with the leader of the UA, and it was his first statement saying it was the FARC who took them, though they left him alive and didn't kidnap the head of the UA. What is that relationship?
Well, I think it's essentially live and let live out there. With groups like the UA. I think that the FARC is well aware that it needs to try to establish at least friendly relationships with the various indigenous groups in areas where it wants to engage military operations, particularly because these are the outlying areas. These are the areas where it's more difficult, indeed, for the military to follow them. And so I think that there is an interest in maintaining at least good relations with them. One would be very hard-pressed to say that the UA or any of the other indigenous groups are part of the apparatus, the military or political apparatus of the FARC, which is by and large still one that emanates out of the older, more settled agrarian areas of Colombia. Most of the people in the FARC are not people who were born out in these colonized zones. They went out there as part of what is known as armed colonization. So my sense is that it's very important for people not to come to the conclusion that because these indigenous folks are out there, that they're necessarily part of the FARC network.
And finally, Professor Jimenez, do you think it's accurate to call the FARC left wing?
Left wing? Well, I think it's accurate to call them agrarian revolutionaries. What left and right wing today means is extremely difficult. But I would say this, that first of all, the claims they are making for land reform, for a widened basis for political participation, are claims that have been made going all the way back to the 19th century. They have extremely deep roots in Colombian political history. They were not transferred to Colombia by agitators or subversives or militants from other parts of the world. What is crucial is that in the 1930s, there were a wide variety of agrarian protests in Colombia where the communists and other leftist movements joined up and provided kind of organizational base as well as kind of ideological matrix for people to understand the circumstances in Colombia. And that's evolved over the years. And so if we strip away some of the socialist revolutionary language of the FARC, what we actually see is a kind, I would argue, a kind of at least on the local level of where FARC operates, a kind of radical Jeffersonianism, you might argue. You know, you want your gun, you want your plot of land, you want the government to serve you well, but you don't want it to be on your back all the time. There is a larger vision of a socialist Colombia, which has been talked a lot about the FARC. It's also deeply nationalistic, that's to say the reduction of the influence of foreign investment. So to some extent, it retains a lot of the populist politics and accents of the 1930s and 40s, which was true for Latin American politics, overlaid on a kind of really old-fashioned radical agrarianism. So to call it leftist doesn't tell us very much about it. It's just simply a label, which, of course, is a carryover label from the Cold War, which will continue to be used against the FARC. And I think that to say they are left-wing, left-wing organization is in fact is used fundamentally as a pejorative category and not necessarily as one which illuminates what is happening in Colombia today.
Professor Michael Jimenez, I want to thank you for joining us, historian at the University of Pittsburgh, and Adam Isaacson, associate at the Demilitarization Program at the Center for International Policy in Washington, D.C. When we come back, we'll take a look at President Clinton's apology in Guatemala for U.S. complicity in the killings over the last 40 years. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President Clinton yesterday admitted to Guatemalans that U.S. support for, quote, widespread repression in a 36-year period of military and paramilitary violence. He said, "For the United States, it's important that I state clearly that the support for military forces or intelligence units which engaged in violent and widespread repression was wrong." He said this as he began a roundtable discussion on Guatemala's search for peace. He made the apology on the third day of his Central American tour, which he wraps up today. As Clinton spoke, several hundred demonstrators outside Guatemala City's National Palace could be heard accusing the United States of complicity in the military and paramilitary violence in which close to 200,000 people have died, mainly Mayan civilian peasants. One of the harshest rebukes of the horrors of the conflict between the army, paramilitary forces, and guerrillas, which ended in 1996, a Guatemalan Truth Commission last month painted a picture of state-sponsored genocide and massacres. The commission also said U.S. military aid and Central Intelligence Agency advisors played a pivotal role in the bloodshed. In today's Washington Post, there is a story about how the United States was closely involved in equipping and training Guatemalan security forces who murdered thousands of civilians in the nation's last 40 years. This has been reported in the alternative press repeatedly over these last four decades. The Washington Post said newly declassified U.S. intelligence documents show that the CIA maintained close ties to the Guatemalan army in the 1980s, when the army and its paramilitary allies were massacring Indian villagers, and U.S. officials were aware of the killings at the time. It said the documents were obtained by the National Security Archive, a private nonprofit group in Washington, and while some had been made available to an independent commission that investigated Guatemalan human rights abuses, others were disclosed yesterday for the first time. One was a January 4, 1966 memo from a U.S. State Department official in which he described how he set up a, quote, safe house in the presidential palace for use by Guatemalan security agents and their U.S. contacts. The safe house became the headquarters for Guatemala's dirty war against Guatemala's largely peasant population. In the 1990s, CIA cables said villages were being burned to the ground, and that in the 80s, the Guatemalan military had dumped suspected guerrillas dead and alive out of aircraft into the ocean. The Washington Post quoted an April 1994 Defense Intelligence Agency memo as saying, in this way, they have been able to remove the majority of the evidence that the prisoners were tortured and killed. We're joined right now by two people who know the history of Guatemala well. Harold Nelson from the Guatemala Human Rights Commission, based in Washington, D.C., and Adriana Portillo, survivor of the military violence in Guatemala, whose family members were disappeared under the orders of a military officer who was trained at the School of the Americas at Fort Benning, Georgia. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Adriana Portillo, what is your response to President Clinton's apology?
I am glad that Clinton, is the president of the United States, has finally acknowledged what we have been saying for many, many years. I'm glad that he has said that it was wrong what the United States did and that it must not be repeated. But unfortunately, for the people of Guatemala, his acknowledgement is not enough. I think as a mother, who has two children disappeared in Guatemala, as a daughter whose father is disappeared in Guatemala, and as a sister, whose baby sister, 18-month-old baby sister, is disappeared in Guatemala, I think that the United States must make reparations for what it did in our country. There are several things that the United States must do to show that it is truly sorry for what it did. First, I think the United States must offer a formal apology to the people of Guatemala. It must ask for forgiveness for what it did. Second, it must tell the truth, the whole truth, about the extent of what it did in our country. It must provide the names of all the CIA agents involved in the gross violations of human rights in Guatemala. And this must be done for the survivors of the war to be able to pursue justice. Third, the United States, I think, must make economic reparations to the survivors of the war. The war totally destroyed the economy. And the people must be able, to have the economic resources to rebuild their villages and to rebuild their communities and their lives. And it is a very, very concrete thing the United States must do to prove that it is sorry for what it did. It must close the School of the Americas. You just said that the School of the Americas played a devastating role in what happened in Guatemala. It trained the soldiers and the officers in counterinsurgency techniques. It trained the soldiers and the officers to torture the people, to disappear people, to kill people, to bomb villages. And it must close the School of the Americas. I truly believe that that is the only way for the United States to make reparations for what it did. Just, acknowledgement of what it did is not enough.
You're listening to Adriana Portillo, survivor of the military violence in Guatemala. Adriana, how did you make it to the United States? We're speaking to you in Chicago.
Yes, I came to the United States with the support of the Sanctuary Movement, which was a very large religious organization that was throughout the 1980s providing safe haven for Central American refugees. They were responding to the refusal of the United States to grant political asylum to Central Americans. And one of my brothers, who, by the way, had been forced to serve in the Army and who had deserted because he was a direct witness of what the United States, via the armies in Guatemala was doing, he came to the United States and made a contact with the Sanctuary Movement. And it was through them that we were able to come. And it took us a month to get from Guatemala to the United States. We walked for 3 days and three nights through the Arizona desert until we made it to Tucson. And from Tucson, we went to Texas, and from Texas to Chicago. All of this with the sponsorship of first Presbyterian church and then Jewish synagogue in Chicago.
Harold Nelson is with us as well from the Guatemalan Human Rights Commission in Washington, D.C. Harold, your organization has worked with all sorts of people, many, many Guatemalans, also the well-known American activists, the lawyer Jennifer Harbury, whose husband was killed. He was a Mayan commandante in the guerrillas by a man trained at the School of the Americas, a CIA agent in Guatemala. He was a Guatemalan military officer. You've worked with Sister Diana Ortiz, Ursula Nunn, who was tortured in Guatemala and who is now in the United States continuing to recover from that torture, but also organizing on behalf of Guatemalan survivors and those killed over the last 40 years. What's your response to this apology of President Clinton?
First, I think we have to understand that what the president referred to as wrong and then referred to as a mistake was, in fact, the immorality of a massive violation of human rights and complicity in genocide. He congratulated the Guatemalans for coming to terms with the past, but the United States now must do so as well if his words are to have any meaning. And by coming to terms with the past, I mean he needs to do these things. In fact, he must do them. First, he must speak to the United States people. He must do it on television, and he must detail our own government's crimes against the Guatemalan people so that the people of the United States will know it. Next, he must declassify all U.S. documents which deal with Guatemala. Third, we must have a truth commission independent of government agencies because they will be the ones being investigated. We must identify those who are directly responsible for the crimes against Guatemalan people and also U.S. citizens. We must identify those in the U.S.
Sorry about that. You are listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! A little overload of the system there, but we are talking to Harold Nelson from the Guatemala Human Rights Commission. Harold?
After identifying those directly responsible for the crimes, we must identify those who ordered those crimes. And we must put these people
speak as loud
trial.
As you can. Speak as loud as you can, that last statement you made.
We must identify those who ordered the crimes, and then we must put them on trial for torture, for murder, for training terrorist members of the Guatemalan army. We must identify, meet with the survivors and the families of the victims in Guatemala. They have a right to know what happened, and they deserve reparations, which must come from the United States. And finally, on this point, the U.S. citizens who are tortured in Guatemala or who had family members killed must know what happened. Jennifer, you mentioned, has a right to know where her husband's body is. Sister Diana Ortiz, who you mentioned, has a right to know who the American was who was in charge of her torturers. These people deserve reparations. They deserve to know the truth. And then we must put into effect policies to stop our own government for doing what it has been doing for 40, 50, and 60 years. Because every 20, 30, or 40 years, we recognize what we've been doing as if we're not going to continue doing it. But we continue doing it, and we've got to stop it.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. And if people want to get in touch with the Guatemala Human Rights Commission, where can they call or where is a site on the web that they can go for more information?
Let me give you our email, which is ghrc@igc.org. Our phone number is 202-526-5999, and our fax 202-526-4611. May I say one more thing? Adriana, you are a remarkable person.
Thank you, Harold.
Well, Harold Nelson and Adriana Portillo, I want to thank you for being with us. Harold Nelson of the Guatemala Human Rights Commission in Washington, Adriana Portillo, a survivor of the Guatemalan military and paramilitary violence of the last 40 years. Again, her family members disappeared under the orders of a military officer trained at the School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As you know, last week I was part of a delegation that was able to get into the Socabaya prison in Arequipa, Peru, and got a chance to meet with and speak with American prisoner Lori Berenson. We were the first American delegation to be able to see Lori. Well, yesterday I joined the delegation, which was put together by the Los Angeles-based human rights group Office of the Americas, in two press conferences. One was held at the Office of the Americas in Los Angeles. Ours was held in New York City, across the street and inside the United Nations. We talked about Lori Berenson's case. We talked about the fact she had been arrested November 30th, 1995, and she has not been able to speak to anyone outside of her family, government investigators, and religious people for the last 3 years. It's very significant that I, as a journalist, am the first journalist to have been able to speak to Lori Berenson, because the president of Peru, Fujimori, has made it a point not to allow her to get her side of the story out. In 1995 and 1996, the beginning, she was charged as a rebel leader of the MRTA, the Tupac Amaru Revolutionary Movement. She was charged in a trial where she could not see the evidence. She was tried by a hooded judge, and she was sentenced by that hooded judge with a soldier also hooded, holding a gun to her and other prisoners' heads. She has not been seen since that time, but by her family. And yesterday at the news conference in New York, we were joined by Lori Berenson's parents, Mark and Rhoda Berenson. And Rhoda Berenson read for the first time a statement that Lori was able to get out of the prison. She had been in the Yanamayo prison for 2.5 years, a very high-altitude prison in the Andes, where she has suffered physically and psychologically, as so many Peruvian prisoners have. She was then moved a day before an OAS investigation, Organization of American States investigation of her case in October, and put in 4 months of solitary confinement in a lower-altitude prison, the Socabaya prison, where we met her soon after that solitary confinement ended. Rhoda Berenson read the statement from her daughter that was addressed to the human rights community of this country.
Esteemed men and women, through this communication, permit me to congratulate you on your important work for human rights. I would like to inform you of some details about me and my case. As you know, I have been confined for more than 2.5 years at Yanamayo Maximum Security Military Prison, accused of being a member of the MRTA and fulfilling the sentence of life imprisonment dictated by a faceless military tribunal. I have never been a member of the MRTA. I have never participated in the planning of a violent act, neither with the MRTA nor anybody else. Neither have I ever promoted violence. And what is more, I do not believe in violence, and it would not be possible for me to participate in violence. I do believe in the ideals of justice and equality. To share the ideals of a more just world for the poor majority does not imply that I share in the use of violence to achieve such goals. In my own way, I have worked for these ideals. In Peru, I sought to learn and find ways to help the most poor and oppressed people. I met with, observed, and studied these people, including their history, their culture, their music. I also tried to observe how the government, the law, and the economically powerful treated the poor. I was writing about what I experienced and learned. I had legitimate journalistic credentials from 2 U.S. publications. I hoped to be able to help the situation of human rights and social justice for the most poor. I still believe in that, and I believe it will happen. Certainly, I have not had real justice. I am completely innocent of the horrendous charges made against me, and there could not be real evidence that shows such crimes. I hope that these details might give you a better basis to facilitate an understanding of my situation, and at the same time, I turn to reiterate my greatest respect and admiration for your important works for the good of humanity. With much respect, Lori Berenson.
That was Rhoda Berenson, Lori's mother, reading for the first time a letter Lori Berenson got out of the prison to the Human Rights Commission, Human Rights Community of the United States. Also at the news conference, Mark Berenson, Lori's father.
Where is my government? Why isn't Madeleine Albright standing up for Lori Berenson, a real American with real American values, caring and concerning for those less fortunate than herself? Where is President Clinton feeling my pain? Enough with the rhetoric, Mr. Clinton. Enough with the rhetoric, Miss Albright. Do your job.
Mark and Rhoda Berenson, the parents of Lori Berenson, speaking at a news conference yesterday in New York City, pushing for the U.S. administration to do something about their daughter, Lori Berenson, imprisoned for life in Peru. She has served 3 years of that sentence. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and if you want more information on Lori Berenson's case, there is a website, www.freelori.org. That's www.freelori.org. Stay with us. Are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman.
I am a senior citizen.
I am about to be married.
I am hurt.
I'm happy to be alive.
My world changed the day I was raped.
I was really afraid to speak up about this.
It's been so important that I talk about it.
You cannot recover from rape in isolation.
You are not alone.
For more information, call 310-366-5584.
For a rape survivor, it doesn't get much harder than this. Speaking about the assault and its aftermath in front of a camera, on a tape recorder, perhaps for the first time. But a group of women have done just that as part of a series of public service announcements aimed at putting a human face on rape statistics. The PSAs are to begin airing this month as an educational tool. They feature 14 women rape survivors from all walks of life and were directed by Kate Miller, who is herself a rape survivor. We are debuting these PSAs for the first time on Democracy Now! Today. Kate Miller is the director of the public service announcements, You're Not Alone, a day honoring women who have survived rape and those who have given them voice. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Kate.
Thank you.
Talk a little more about the PSAs and also your own experience as a rape survivor.
Well, I think they go hand in hand. As a survivor, about 4 years ago, I was violated in a home invasion. It was an armed, very violent home invasion in Los Angeles.
What do you mean by home invasion?
I was at home with some friends on a Sunday afternoon, and two young men came into my home with guns, people we obviously didn't know, and took over our life for about 3 hours, and therefore changed our life for, since. But at that point, people really came out to me in a big way, numbers of women who were close friends who I had no idea that they had maybe, a similar experience. And I really just felt the need to speak up for these people, and I felt the need to put a face on the statistics.
And so these PSAs are airing, and they're also promoting an event that's going to be taking place in Los Angeles in April. That is a national event, and it's been organized by Karen Palmer, co-coordinator of the Rainbow Sisters Project. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Karen, also speaking to us from Los Angeles. Karen, are you there? We'll go to Karen in just 1 minute. But Kate Miller, can you describe this day that you are leading up to in April?
I think it will be a very unique event. I don't think it's ever been done before. We're expecting a few hundred women and their friends and family. Everyone's welcome. It's free admission. This will be the first event will be held in Los Angeles. And really what it's for is to give survivors a voice, to bring back some maybe power and control over their life that usually is taken from you when you are a rape victim. We're looking for people across the board, all different walks of life from different sectors of society. And I have to say that really, that's one of the reasons this PSA was really important to me, because it really shows the different faces of women who are affected by this crime. It can be anyone. And when you see these PSAs, they're maybe even a bit more effective when you see them on television, because you really see the faces that could be anyone's mother, your sister, your neighbor, your boss. And I really expect and hope all of these different types of women to show up on April 17th.
Karen Palmer has just joined us, Kate Miller. And our listeners who have been with us from the beginning of Democracy Now! May remember an extended interview we did with Karen about a year ago. Her case, her survival of a rape, was actually dramatized on Dateline NBC. It was very controversial. Karen, though it was the focus, she was the focus of an hour documentary, very much objected to the way they portrayed what happened to her. And she's been working since then on taking back her story and the messages that she wants to put out. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Karen Palmer.
Thank you, Amy. I just want to say real quickly that I want to congratulate you on your Polk Award that you won yesterday. You really deserve it, and you're a wonderful journalist.
Well, thanks very much. Also, congratulations to Jeremy Scahill, who produced that documentary with me. But, Karen, in your case, you survived a rape a few years ago, and you now somehow have the energy to put together this national conference. Can you talk a little more about what this conference means and the kind of people who are going to be involved?
Well, we've involved, all kinds of women, from grandmothers to teenage mothers to all rape survivors are invited to come to this event. And actually, we've been getting phone calls all the way from Alaska to Minnesota, so people are flying in to be part of this. We are honoring several special guests, which includes someone who you mentioned on your show earlier today, which was Sister Deanna Ortiz, will be flying in from Washington, D.C. to participate because she, of course, is a survivor of most brutal rape and torture in Guatemala. Jeannie Bolin will also be speaking, who's a world-renowned forensic sketch artist. Nancy Rain, who wrote a wonderful book called After Silence, Rape and My Journey Back, and Charlotte Pierce Baker, who wrote Surviving the Silence, Black Women's Stories of Rape, and Jamie Calvin, who's a man who's written a book about his wife's assault called Working with Available Light.
Actually, we have Jamie Calvin on the phone with us as well. That book, Working with Available Light, A Family's World After Violence, tells the story of how a family deals with the rape of one of its members. Jamie Calvin, thanks for joining us as well.
Thank you.
Well, we don't usually have men on the radio. You don't hear them on television talking about surviving the rape of a loved one, of a woman that they are with. Tell us your perspective on this story. Tell us your perspective.
Yeah, I think it's important that male voices join the conversation about sexual violence. What this book attempts to do is to recount in sort of novelistic detail the 5 years following an assault in the life of a woman in a marriage, in a family. We have two children who were 4 and 8 at the time of the rape. And to suggest...
You're listening to Democracy Now! As we try to go back to our sound here, having a little trouble with the phone system, and we're talking to Jamie Calvin, whose wife survived a rape. Jamie?
Can you hear me?
Yes, yes we can.
So this is the story of somebody, or told from the perspective of a person who loves the victim, who's not himself the principal victim, trying to make sense of what's happened, and to it's really, in a way, a book that's an act of listening, of a deep sort of listening to the account my wife gave over time of what had happened to her world and her sense of the world. It's very much a book of sort of inquiry. The title, Working with Available Light, is actually a term from photography. My wife's a black and white photographer, and it describes the kind of photography she does, not using artificial lighting, in a sense trying to draw light out of darkness. And that also suggests something about the orientation of the book, trying to understand what can be understood about somebody else's experience, and also recognizing that there are things that will forever be beyond your grasp. And there's an act of, I think, necessary respect in recognizing that. And the book evokes the world we live in on the south side of Chicago in fairly thick, rich detail. And I think one of the ways in which it may differ from other accounts of sexual violence is I think it's part of the nature of violence to be hugely isolating, of just, you know, kind of inflict a hellish sort of isolation on the victim.
Jamie Calvin, we wanted to play a second PSA. This is actually a video, and so people can use their imagination. There are some silences or times for crying in it. But this is the second PSA that has been produced by Kate Miller, the director of the You Are Not Alone project that is beginning to air around the country.
I am a mother.
I am a senior citizen.
I am a wife.
Soy tu hermana.
I am East German.
I'm hopeful.
I am about to be married.
I am learning to trust.
I am angry.
I'm happy to be alive.
My world changed the day I was raped.
It's hard to talk about.
It was not consensual.
Once you're violated, it doesn't go away.
I was really afraid to speak up about this.
Talk to other people, because it's an amazing difference.
I am a survivor. I am not a victim.
It wasn't my fault, and it's not your fault.
Remember that you are not alone.
Something needs to be done, and it needs to be done now.
For more information, call 310-366-5584.
Again, the second of the public service announcements that are beginning to run around the country, part of the You Are Not Alone Day honoring women who have survived rape and those who have given them voice. Our guests on the phone, Kate Miller, who is director of the project, Karen Palmer, co-coordinator of the Rainbow Sisters Project, and Jamie Calvin, journalist and author of the book Working with Available Life. Working with Available Light, his wife was raped, and he talks about a family's world after violence. Karen Palmer, in your journey back as you rebuilt your life after your rape, what was the turning point for you where you felt you had regained some sense of yourself before the rape? And what do you think were the most unhelpful ways that people responded to it?
Oh, boy, what a question. Well, first of all, I thought I had done everything right after the rape. I reported it immediately. I spoke out about it. I took self-defense courses. I immediately went into counseling. I went into group counseling. I thought I had done everything possible that you could possibly do in order to recover. And I thought I was doing great. And then the third anniversary of my rape happened, and I fell apart. But in falling apart, with flashbacks and nightmares and things that I hadn't experienced for a very long time, I I had this vision of women coming together, women who have survived this terrible thing, coming together and giving each other support, and I thought that that was going to heal me. And when I was able to speak about that vision and get other people interested in it and start working on that, I feel that was a huge turning point for me. And we're really excited about this event that will be happening April 17th in Los Angeles, this day of honoring women who've survived rape. As far as the terrible things that people said, I mean, it was pretty unbelievable. My neighbors asked me what I was doing out so late. People asked me what I was wearing that night. They asked, you know, why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? I mean, it was really, you know, they told me that I was hysterical about my rape. I mean,
Karen.
it's just extremely insensitive comments. I think that that is something that is universally experienced by women who do talk about their rapes publicly.
Karen, in your case, you also had to deal with the Santa Monica police, which many people do after a rape, have to deal with their local police department. And it was an issue you have made into a national issue, is how police departments deal with rape victims.
Unfortunately, things have not changed as much as we would have liked in the last 25 years when the anti-rape crisis movement started. I just recently heard a statistic that less women are reporting their rapes now, and I think it does have something to do with the fact that women fear being re-victimized once they report, and the truth is that it does happen. The police department couldn't have treated me more insensitively. I mean, they put their fingers in my face and screamed at me in the emergency room. I mean, totally mishandled my case in terms of collection of evidence. I mean, they didn't take the issue of rape seriously, the crime of rape seriously. They didn't treat it like it was second only to homicide. I think the Santa Monica Police Department is doing some of that now because we went public and spoke out against.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for being with us, and I want to give out the phone number of the You Are Not Alone project one more time. Karen Palmer?
Yes, it's 310-366-5584. And everyone's welcome. It's free to the public, but we are taking donations too. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Karen Palmer, co-coordinator of the Rainbow Sisters Project, Kate Miller, director of the PSA Project, You Are Not Alone, and Jamie Calvin. His book is called Working with Available Light, A Family's World After Violence. It's published by Norton. If you'd like a cassette copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. Special thanks to Robert Knight, Dred Scott Keyes, and Silas Kelly. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! From the studios of WBAI in New York.